Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. In the news today, Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken is facing new calls to resign, including from our own senators representing Washington State. Patty Murray says, "I'm shocked and appalled by Senator Franken's behavior. It's clear to me that this has been a deeply harmful, persistent problem and a clear pattern over a long period of time. It's time for him to step aside." End of quote. Senator Maria Cantwell says, "Senator Franken's actions are disturbing, egregious, and demonstrate a pattern of serious misconduct and abuse. It is time for Senator Franken to resign from office." And with us now is the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, Tina Podlodowski. Good to talk to you again. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much, Bill. And greetings from Spokane, Washington today.
Hello, Spokane. So Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell now calling for Franken to resign. Do you agree with that call?
I do agree with the call. I think the Democrats as a party are leading in this particular effort when there are issues related to making sure that we're listening to the survivors of these sorts of issues and assaults. And certainly with the resignation of Representative John Conyers and calling for the resignation of Senator Al Franken, I think we're really walking our talk on this issue. I'm kind of waiting to see when the Republicans are going to do the same thing with their gentlemen who are in trouble, particularly Roy Moore in Alabama.
Well, let's talk about those politics, because you have the Republican National Committee supporting Roy Moore. You have the Republican House Speaker, Paul Ryan, said it's a watershed moment, these allegations, these women being believed, except he won't say much about the allegations against President Trump. But your job, Tina, is to get Democrats elected and kept in office. Do you worry at all that your party will claim that moral high ground but lose political power?
Well, what's the point of having quote-unquote political power unless you have morals and values and community behind it? I think that that's the whole point here, is that there are apparently places that Republicans are willing to go that Democrats are not. Look, we're fighting a case right now at the Supreme Court that basically says if you sell a gay couple a cake, then you support gay marriage. If you use that rationale, then if you are giving money to Roy Moore, then you are supporting pedophilia. Is that what the Republican Party is saying about their Senate candidate? And they have not said anything. And in fact, my counterpart, Susan Hutchison, the state party chair, refuses to say if she supports Roy Moore or not. She refuses to say if the state party supports what the RNC is doing or what President Trump has certainly done. So I think it's time for us to stop the madness, look at the values equation here as well, because it's not a matter of which party is in power. It's a matter of how we as Washingtonians and Americans want to send values to our kids, to our communities, to our families, and certainly sexual harassment and sexual assault is not a value of the Democratic Party.
Well, let's talk about where we draw the line. First of all, regarding today's news, does it matter to you that so far none of Senator Al Franken's accusers, none of those allegations are from his time as a U.S. Senator?
You know, it's a pattern, and it's a very disturbing pattern, and I don't think anything in that disturbing pattern And it seems that we're about to have a fire drill here.
Oh.
Where I am in the water.
Well, I hope you're safe.
This particular hotel.
Yes, if you have to go, you have to go. Wow. I hear it. I heard the word emergency. What do you want to do, Tina?
So we will leave the building,
yes,
to make this happen. But
okay, cell
I think
phone.
My final point.
Will you call me back? Will you call me back in a moment on your
I
cell?
I will call you back in a moment, Bill. Thank you.
We're gonna
bye bye.
That was Tina Podlodowski doing probably the prudent thing, it sounds like, getting out of that hotel room. She's the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, and I wasn't finished with my questions for her, so we've got more to talk about on that subject on The Record on KUOW. Now, I want to turn for a moment to another issue that I'm just learning about, and the aphorism here would be, when the elephants fight, the grass gets trampled, because some big pachyderms are wrestling now. Google just pulled YouTube, which it owns. Google pulled YouTube off of Amazon devices in retaliation for something that Amazon did. So we have Seattle's tech news site, GeekWire, the editor Todd Bishop here with us. Hiya, Todd.
Hi, Bill.
I wanted to ask you first, why are Amazon and Google tangling?
First off, they're very strong competitors in a lot of different areas. The most Wild West of them right now is the home personal assistant market, where Google Assistant and Amazon's Alexa are competing with Echo devices and Google Home. You, though, have this content clash that's happening where Google controls YouTube. Google owns YouTube. Yeah. YouTube is a fundamental part of online video viewing. It's
the biggest, yes, by far, I assume, video service in the world.
Absolutely. It's hard to have a compelling streaming device without YouTube on it.
Right.
People are just not going to buy it.
Right.
And Amazon, on the other hand, is the dominant e-commerce player. It's hard to have a successful online sales strategy without some component of Amazon.
Even as rich as Google is this a big problem for Google?
It can be at least an increased challenge. Certainly, Google is one of the few companies that can get around being boxed out of Amazon, which Amazon has done with Google's Nest products and other products that compete with some of the things that Amazon offers. Mm-hmm. So here you have Google making this really bold move this week. They said it was essentially reciprocity for Amazon not selling the Google products, cutting YouTube off for the second time from the Amazon Echo Show, which is the display screen version of the Echo with the Alexa personal assistant, mm-hmm, as well as Amazon's Fire TV. Really a fascinating battle here that has huge implications for consumers, as we're all trying to stitch together these replacements to our traditional cable TV packages.
That's what I've done. I dropped my TV service for the Amazon Fire. Is this our future, though? We can't have it all. We have to choose between what Google has and what Amazon has and what Apple has.
It certainly is the potential for our future if these companies can't figure out some kind of cohesive offering that has all of their services on all of their devices. To me, this is a couple things. First, a big risk for both Amazon and Google, because when you take your strength in one area of a market and leverage it to punish a competitor in the other area, that is classic antitrust. Now, if we had a presidential administration, a Justice Department that was really interested in going after that, which I would say they probably aren't at this point, that would be a huge risk.
Even though neither Google nor Amazon is at risk of being snuffed out by the other?
Exactly, and that is the one safety net that both of them might have. They both are dominant in their own ways. But this is essentially what Microsoft got accused of in the late 90s, early 2000s. Microsoft had a dominant position in operating systems, and it used that to punish and penalize its competitors in areas like web browsers and media players. And at the time, the Clinton administration went after Microsoft over that and really threw Microsoft for a loop in a lot of different ways. To me, this is an example of the fact that even though we're getting away from one giant monopoly in our cable providers, mm-hmm, we're essentially stepping into another area where we have these dominant giant companies of a different era still determining what we can access and not. And there is a real risk that this fragmentation will essentially just require us to recreate the bundles ourselves. In other words, you've got to get Netflix.
Yeah.
All this, you already are doing this to some extent. And then these battles between these tech companies just exacerbates the problem.
I thought it was going to be Comcast that would deprive me, right, of videos when the Trump administration blows up net neutrality.
Exactly. And it is ironic, especially in the case of Amazon, because if you talk to any Amazon executive, the first thing they tell you, it's hard to get through a 10-minute conversation with an Amazon executive without them telling you that their focus is on the customer. They start with the customer and work backward. Well, if you're doing that, in this case, you're going to offer Google's products on Amazon.
Yeah.
And likewise, Google should be offering access to YouTube on all of Amazon's devices. I mean, they should be setting aside these sort of competitive, small, petty issues and say what's best for the consumer. That really is the way that this should be working. And when the consumer's best interests are not at the heart of what these companies are doing, that's when, regulators really should be looking at this and saying, well, so let's step in and see what's going on here.
Is there any good news here, Todd Bishop? What's the good news?
There is so much content out there to consume. Frankly, you could probably satisfy yourself with just one of these streaming services.
I could live without YouTube on my Amazon Fire.
This is definitely a first world problem,
yes,
that we're talking about.
Fair
here.
Enough.
Granted, it does hit our pocketbooks if we are paying a lot of money. That said, it is good that the traditional cable bundle is being disrupted. You have tons and tons of options here.
Yeah.
Granted, you might just be walking into another situation where it's got its own problems.
At least CBS wasn't stopping me from watching HBO.
Exactly. Well, that is true. I mean, CBS was not going to Comcast and saying, if you include HBO in the bundle, we're not going to be on it. But to some extent, I think this is a Wild West right now. And there is at least the potential that long term it'll work out for the best.
I like your first world problem perspective.
Yes,
it is true.
Exactly.
It's going to be okay. All right. Well, that's the news. Unless a truce is reached, my understanding is that YouTube stops working on Fire TV in January. And YouTube was supposed to disappear from the Echo show yesterday. It's unclear whether that actually happened. But anyway,
I was not able to get it up on my Echo show
this
morning. YouTube was not able to get that activated. So,
okay.
Yeah.
The elephants are wrestling.
That's
and
right.
That's Todd Bishop, the editor of Seattle's tech news site, GeekWire. I always feel good when you're explaining things to me. Thank you.
I'll do my best, Bill.
Okay. Come back again. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I think we have the chair of the State Democratic Party back with us, safe and sound, to continue the conversation. So we'll do that in just a moment. Come back. Okay, back to The Record on KUOW. As I mentioned, the news today is that a group of U.S. senators, including our Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, are saying it's time for Minnesota's Democratic Senator Al Franken to resign. And I started talking about this with the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party when Tina Podlodowski got this announcement in her hotel room that you heard that there was an emergency and she had to get out. What's happening, Tina?
Well, apparently it was a fire drill, Bill, so it must have been the conversation we're having with this, dare I say it, hot topic.
Yes, it was the hot talk. Okay, well, we're glad you're okay. So we were starting to talk about where we draw the line and Al Franken, but these alleged incidents didn't happen while he was in office. But what about Roy Moore? But what about Donald Trump? And I want to revisit the story of our former Seattle mayor, Ed Murray. Four men accused the mayor of abuse. You eventually called on him to resign, but not until September. Does that decision look any different to you today?
Yes, and I've said that in the past. And I think that that's part of the issue here as we debate what's happening with folks. I think like an Al Franken, for example, which is people have relationships with folks. In the case of Ed Murray, it was somebody I knew for 30 years. The initial incidents were so out of character with the individual that I knew and had worked with from political standpoint and a personal standpoint. But eventually, and I think fairly quickly, it became really clear that this is a situation where you do believe the victims and we all have to step up. And we all have to get past inherent biases that we might have around any of those issues.
Are you saying you had trouble separating your personal relationship and past with Ed Murray?
It was not just a trouble separating the personal relationship, but keep in mind, I've done advocacy work in the LGBTQ community for over 40 years now, and consistently, one of the things that's utilized against the LGBT community is that we prey on young people. So a knee-jerk reaction, I think, for me was, wait a minute, is this just a political game? What's happening here? And it was incredibly important to make sure that the facts of the situation were being looked at, that it was beyond any personal relationship that I had or any community relationship I had. And it was very clear that Ed needed to resign. And I think that certainly all of us here in Seattle are now in hyper-aware. And I think around the country, folks are hyper-aware. And I think our need to make sure that we're listening to survivors and we're not taking anything for granted in these situations has become paramount. And thank goodness for the Me Too movement. And they are now on the cover of Time magazine. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it's the start of a new trend as well.
Well, Tina, it sounds like you're being humble and not defensive. And also you have a personal experience with having a knee-jerk, as you said, reason for not automatically believing an accuser. And we're all working through this together.
Absolutely. And I think that this gives folks an opportunity to sit down and remove biases that they might have, remove their own frames and their own privilege around these issues as well, and how this impacts women, particularly in communities of color, women in the LGBTQ community, as well as women in the heterosexual community, and men, too, who have been victimized by harassment and worse.
Final question for the State to Democratic Party chair. In Olympia, we're talking about this, too. As you know, there are accusations there. A group of women led by a former lobbyist is saying, we need to take politics out of this. We need a safe, quote, safe, neutral place for people to share and report experiences. Do you support that? And if so, why weren't we having that safe, neutral place already?
I do support that. And I think one of the reasons why is, again, sort of our inherent biases and our willingness to give people that we know a pass potentially on these issues. I think it's incredibly important. It's one of the things the state party chair, when I came on board in February, we said we would do the work for the first ever statewide code of conduct that deals with things like sexual harassment. We have it. We are about to put a process in place in terms of what happens in those kinds of issues. And then we're also working with our colleagues, our Democratic colleagues in the House and the Senate, to look at the whole campaign and candidate structure, at least for Democrats in the state of Washington, to make sure that the candidates we elect and the campaigns that we have are safe for everyone. And that's incredibly important. And I call on the Republican Party to do the same thing. I'd love to hear Susan Hutchison say, I don't support Roy Moore, I don't support the donations by the RNC, and I don't support what President Trump has done or his support of Roy Moore in this particular Alabama race.
Tina Podadowski chairs the Washington State Democratic Party. Tina, thank you for this time.
Thank you so much, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Now let's turn to the task of choosing a police chief, one of the most important decisions a mayor can make. Those are the words of Seattle's mayor, Jenny Durkin, and she's going to have to make that choice in the next few months. This week, Seattle's police chief, Kathleen O'Toole, announced she's stepping down in 2018. She spent 3 years helping the Seattle Police Department change the way it uses force out in the field. Now a new chief is going to be tasked with seeing Seattle through the end of these federally mandated reforms. With us to talk about this now, we have the deputy director of the ACLU of Washington, Michelle Storms. Michelle Storms has been thinking about what Seattle needs from a new police chief. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Also with us, state representative and Seattle police officer Morgan Irwin. Welcome to you, representative.
Thank you, Bill, and just because I always have to say this, the views I'm about to express are my own and in no way represent the City of Seattle or the Seattle Police Department.
Okay. We're glad to have your views. Representative Irwin, this new police chief's also going to be your new boss in the police department. What do you want from your new boss?
I'm really excited that Chief Best, Deputy Chief Best, Carmen Best, is going to be our interim. I think she's an incredibly strong leader. I think she speaks with a clarity and a voice that can be heard by the community. And I'm actually kind of excited to be under her leadership. I think she's going to do really well by us.
What do you think the city most needs from your new boss?
You know, and that's hard. I think the biggest thing that we need to do in Seattle, you know, with my perspective, is we've got to do a better job of communicating as a police department. We've gone to some social media stuff, and I think that's mostly positive. There's been kind of some faux pas there, but I think for the most part, people need to hear the story of what it is that we're doing. You know, good, bad, and different. When we have something bad that happens, people need to know about it right away. When we have something good that happens, we need to know about it right away. We need to be able to tell the story, and not in a way that we're, you know, marketing ourselves, but just tell the story so people understand exactly what's happening, and take away, you know, kind of that, well, you know, I wonder what's happening or what could be happening, because when people start to tell their own narrative in absence of facts, that's when we end up in kind of irrational situations.
Okay, someone who can tell the story of what the Seattle Police Department is doing. Michelle Storms with the ACLU of Washington, what do you think Seattle's top priority is from a new police chief?
So, you know, at the ACLU, the things that we think about a lot relate to excessive use of force in policing, racial bias in policing, dealing with crisis intervention and mental health. These are some of the key issues that we pay attention to, because frankly, where the biggest problems have happened have typically been in the intersection of those issues. So we look forward to someone who will pay close attention to those and continue to work, as Chief O'Toole has done, on increasing the training, improving the training, holding officers accountable, working very closely with community to address community concerns regarding policing. These are some of the key things that we hope to see.
Well, Michelle, you bring up training, which is something that was brought up earlier this week. I talked to a former Seattle City Council member, Kirsten Harris Talley, and here's what she said about training.
Putting a lot of time and effort into non-lethal policing models and training is a game changer. Right now, the models are upside down, which is why De-escalate Washington is such an important campaign. We have far too much training that's on shooting range and other lethal interaction training and not on anti-bias training, de-escalation training. How do you work with mental health issues? How do you work with other issues that can accelerate in the field if you don't have the training to actually de-escalate those situations?
Officer Irwin, would you agree the training models for Seattle Police are upside down?
That's a perfect clip to play. When I'm talking about the ability to communicate with the community and say what it is that we're doing, this is a perfect example because, you know, this year I think I had 48 hours of training, and four of it was on firearms and in the range. Everything else was de-escalation or anti-bias training. We went to the Jewish Heritage Center here in Seattle, and we had a training on, you know, kind of the rise of Nazism and where police, you know, the police part in that in, you know, in Germany and the Brown Code. That's what we're doing in Seattle. But I know that's not kind of the perception. But if you look at the training that we are doing in this city. And I understand completely.
Does that seem like the right mix?
Well, I think I'd spent 4 hours this year doing defensive tactics. So that's kind of your hands-on skills, kind of those mid-step skills between verbal skills and using greater amounts of force. If anything, I think we need maybe more of that, because if those skills aren't on point, that's when officers can lose control of a situation and things escalate even further. But I guess I would say that there is a perception, absolutely, that Seattle police officers, all we do is we train to, you know, use force or whatever. But right now, I mean, that's maybe 8 or 16 hours out of a 48-hour training year. The rest is all focused on de-escalation, case law, dealing with people from various cultural backgrounds. I mean, that is the vast majority of our training right now. And I mean, that just is what it is. That's not an opinion. I mean, that is what we're doing.
Okay. ACLU's Michelle Storms, any reaction to that mix of training?
That sounds good. That sounds like fabulous training. And so two things about it, one related to the training and one related to the communicating it out. The training is a piece of it, right? A question that I have is, how is the culture changing in the force around these issues of de-escalation, anti-bias, and so forth? I'm just asking that as a question. It's not an opinion, because I think that where we have to get is a real change of mindset around sanctity of life and about community safety. So I would throw that out. And then I have a thought about the communication, too, if I may.
Well, can I get a good answer to your good question first?
Sure.
You're speaking for yourself, but the ACLU would like to know, how is the culture actually changing based on this training? What have you seen?
Yeah, and so one of the things that you can kind of run into with some of these trainings is that, and I don't know if it's just a function of the training or how they're presented, but whether it's an outside force, that's kind of coming in and saying, hey, this is what we think you should do, or it's written internally. When we talk about things like implicit bias, where this predetermined, like everybody has internal biases, and it's our job every day to combat those and make sure they don't become explicit bias. Those are the sorts of trainings that we focus on a lot. And I think culturally we do care about that. I remember going through a training, it was last year, and it was kind of LGBT focused. And I was on a call, a week later, and someone who was probably not on the binary scale in terms of sexuality, and I asked that person, what's your preferred pronoun? And they went from saying, I'm not going to give you any kind of a statement. This was at a shooting at the Rainier Valley. I'm not going to give you any kind of statement. And then I asked that, and you could just see him relax and say, oh, well, this person gets it. And that person ended up giving me, a full statement. And I was able to get, a lot of information for our detectives because of it. So I think the trainings are making a difference, from my perspective as a patrol officer. And I work in a pretty rough part of the city, comparatively. And the folks that I work with, we take it to heart, and we try and use those sorts of tools to go out and do the job better. Because ultimately, I mean, it makes it easier to do good police work when you're doing it in a way that people appreciate.
That's really helpful. It actually gives me a segue into my other comment about communicating out to community, because, you know, I think you mentioned earlier using social media and using certain other venues to share the story of what the police force is doing. And I wonder if that really gets to everybody. And I guess it gets back to the community policing model, which I know was something that was a focus of Chief O'Toole's attention. That when you're in the community and you're sharing stories with the community, or you're having the opportunity, as you had, Representative Irwin, to ask this person about their pronouns, that's when the community really hears the message, when they see the change. And I think part of the disconnect a lot of times is that we know that training has changed, but then, you know, we still have shootings and we still have situations that, from the community perspective, don't appear to be acceptable or justified, that appear to be still excessive use of force.
And those are, I think that's when communication is most important. I mean, we had, you know, kind of a couple of higher profile shootings, but instead of picking one that was really controversial, which can probably be a segment all on its own, and even right. has been a segment all on its own, mm-hmm. We had a shooting just off of Dearborn. A man charged a female officer with a knife, and the shooting was ruled completely justified, and most folks who saw the video, you know, looked at it and were like, oh, yeah, that's a guy with a great big knife running at an officer. Those are the sorts of things that people were able to make that call for themselves, because the video was released within, I think, 24 or 48 hours. You know, detailed statements were given within 72 hours. That model of communication where people are given facts when they're generating their own narrative, that's what we need to do, in my opinion, and that's the way that we stop things from becoming something they're not. Because nobody wants a bad shooting, but also nobody wants a good shooting that's made to look bad, because the narrative is, it's people lose control of it.
We're talking with State Representative and Seattle Police Officer, both Morgan Irwin and Michelle Storms, Deputy Director of the ACLU of Washington. We're talking about the search for the new Seattle Police Chief. Michelle, you were on the hiring committee for Kathleen O'Toole. How involved was the community in that hiring process? Was that because earlier this week, that former Seattle City Council member said, we need much more involvement than what the Mayor Durkin is envisioning right now.
So, and I haven't seen what the plan is for Mayor Durkin currently, but when we did this some years ago, we did have a search committee, and then we also had a community advisory committee. We had a number early on, I think even before drafting the actual position description, we had a number of sessions in a variety of communities all around Seattle. I went to a couple of them myself on the South End, and they were asking the community, what are you looking for? So that's definitely something that I'd love to see happen again. Beyond that, though, I don't recall there being additional outreach into the community. I think that would be a good thing to look at, especially in this time where we're really trying to build up the strength of the Community Police Commission and really help the community understand that they have a voice and a role to play with the law enforcement agency.
Representative Irwin, we are coming out of this federally mandated reform, this consent decree from the U.S. Justice Department. So it's about to be a new time in the Seattle Police Department. You said communication is important. That's a given for a lot of organizations and municipalities and businesses. What is the number one change, if any, or is it just stay the course, that you would like Seattleites to come out of this next police chief's term and saying, wow, this is what was accomplished under this police chief?
Well, not to be too reliant on the words of others, but I think it was Merrick Bob actually that said, until the cake is baked, you can still pull the ingredients out. And we still don't have a contract. I mean, we're, I think, close to 1,200 days without a contract. You know, no member of my union's gone on strike. Everybody shows up to work. We continue to do the job that we're paid to do. But increasingly, we're looking around and saying, you know, are we doing this in good faith? You know, is the city negotiating with us in good faith? I mean, they've already pretty blatantly broken some labor practice laws mandating body of work issues, you know, during this time. And hopefully what we can do over the next, I guess, generation of police work is show that the police department is of the people, and that the government is of the people, and that we're working together. I think oftentimes in government, we tend to circle the wagons, you know, between, you know, police and fire and you kind of your executive branch and you circle the wagons, and then we shoot in instead of out, and it's so destructive. And so hopefully we can, under this next regime, find people who can work together and say, hey, we all need each other. Let's work together. Let's do it in good faith, and let's do the best we can for our community, and let's let them know what we're doing as often as possible.
And Michelle Storms with the ACLU of Washington, when we're talking later about how Seattle's new police chief has done, how would you evaluate that new chief's success?
You know, I think that there's something that Representative Irwin said that I think I really agree with, a sort of a coming together. It would be a real indication of success if there was trust in both directions, if the community felt a sense of trust that the police department was there to be in the guardian spirit, in the community-minded spirit, and if the law enforcement was going into communities where they had relationships with people and knew that these are good folks and we can work together. So someone who could create that space where there is that trust and strength of relationship, that would be a real triumph.
Seattle Police Department at a crossroads with Chief Kathleen O'Toole on the way out soon, and a search underway, and the Deputy Chief Carmen Best in that role for now, an internal candidate. We've been talking with Michelle Storms with the ACLU of Washington, and Morgan Irwin is a Washington State representative and a Seattle police officer. He speaks for himself. Thanks to both of you for this.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the conversation.
Thanks, Bill.
This hour, we've been talking about all these revelations, high-profile revelations of sexual harassment and assault in the workplace. Some of the women who've spoken out about their own sexual harassment stories are on the cover of Time magazine today, The Silence Breakers. That's 2017's People of the Year. What's new here is that so many women are speaking publicly about the constraints and pressures they have to overcome at work. Constraints that men don't have to think about. But there's history here, too. KUOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin, has brought in a new book of poems that takes a historical look at women battling those constraints and pressures and succeeding. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Bill.
What is this new poetry collection?
It's called Mary's Dust, and it's by a Seattle poet named Melinda Miller. The poems give voice to 2,000 years worth of historical Marys, beginning with Mary, the mother of Jesus, and continuing through the centuries. These poems are meticulously researched, and in them we encounter some famous Marys, like Mary Magdalene and Marie Curie, and many largely unknown Marys, like the Victorian explorer Mary Henrietta Kingsley, as well as various mystics, scientists, and artists.
All real-life Marys.
All real-life Marys.
What a great idea. And Elizabeth, what most grabbed your attention in these poems?
Well, you know, what really grabbed me, Bill, was the poems about women who managed to have a sense of agency about their own lives, but also about the historical moment they found themselves in, despite the constraints of their time and society. So the poem I want you to hear is called Covert Acts. It's set in the American Civil War, and it gives us three different Marys who were active participants on the Union side.
Who is the first Mary?
First, we hear how Melinda Miller imagines Private Mary Galloway. She was just one of an unknowable number of women who disguised themselves as men to fight in the Civil War. So here's Melinda Miller reading the opening of her poem, Covert Acts.
Covert Acts, Private M. Galloway, Field Hospital near Antietam, September 18, 1862. I am discovered. After months of going off alone to piss in the woods, as they all do anyway, the latrines being so foul, and to bleed there monthly, but then we all bled, didn't we? one way or another. After sleeping clothed and bathing clothed, and that, too, no different from the rest, all of us clothed in grime, no laundry is the equal to, unless the angels' washing house in heaven. After pitching my voice low enough to pass, after smudging my chin with coffee grounds and acting stubble proud like all the boys, after learning to smoke and learning to swagger and swear and fire a rifle under fire and to stomach hardtack and maggot-ridden bacon, after answering to reveille, advance, retreat, hold the line, hold your fire and fire at will, after fix bayonets and damn your eyes, after all that, some rebel boy, damn his eyes, puts a ball in my chest, and there's no hiding what else is there. When Miss Barton, thank God it was a woman anyway, peels the filthy woolens from the wound and looks me in the eyes and almost smiles.
That was Melinda Miller reading the first section of Covert Acts from her new collection, Mary's Dust. Elizabeth, you said this was meticulously researched. Do we know whether the poet got information from Mary Galloway's diary? Do we know is this or whether this is completely imagined and fictionalized?
Well, my understanding is that she did use primary sources and that the scene that she imagines did actually happen, that Clara Barton, who was an important innovator in nursing and went on to found the American Red Cross, that she was the one who actually discovered that Mary Galloway was, in fact, a woman.
Wow. Yeah, you hear her mentioning Miss Barton there at the end. That's the famous nurse.
Exactly. And one of the things that I want to point out is that almost smile that Clara Barton gives as she looks at this female soldier. I hear that as a fleeting image of solidarity. Mary Galloway is seen. Her courage is recognized.
We're going to get into that. That metaphor is going to come up again, who's seen and unseen. But you said, Elizabeth, there are three voices in this poem, so who speaks next?
Well, this next one is going to be Melinda Miller imagining the thoughts of Mary Edwards Walker, who was the first female surgeon to serve in the United States Army.
M. E. Walker, field surgeon. Battle of Chickamauga, September 19 to 20, 1863. Walking among the stretchers, I imagine them, these boys and men, running in the battlefield, the battle woods, through slabs of light and falling under the weight of it. And as each falls, his foolish heart keeps closing on fistfuls of blood until it has wrung the body dry. Or if not, if they make it this far, gangrene likely does the job instead. First they look at you, eyes mad with terror, and then they start to sink away, back and down a fathomless well of thought, farther and farther and out of sight and out of sight. And if the last face they saw was a woman's, mine, a woman dressed in trousers so I could stand in their blood, not in a skirt sopping with the weight of it, does anyone suppose it can have mattered? Or that my own heart will not, from the sight of all this dying, also wring me dry?
We're listening to poet Melinda Miller reading from her poem Covert Acts. And again, Elizabeth, there's the power of people seeing each other on the battlefield.
Exactly. So Melinda Miller gives us this scene of this woman who's managed to become a field surgeon in the middle of the 19th century. And what Melinda creates here is this little scene of Dr. Mary Walker meditating on that reciprocal act of seeing. She sees the soldier suffering. And they see her female face, this woman who wears men's clothing for its practicality so that she can better attempt to help them, not as Private Galloway has to do in the previous poem, as a disguise. So there's this mutual recognition of their humanity, I think, really there.
So now, Elizabeth, we're about to meet yet one more Mary.
Yes. In this final section, we meet Mary Bowser, a freedwoman who posed as a slave in Jefferson Davis's home so that she could gather intelligence for the Union. And Jefferson Davis, of course, was the president of the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Melinda Miller.
M. E. Bowser, a.k.a. Ellen Bond, Union spy, home of Jefferson Davis, Richmond, 1864. Slow-witted, unlettered, of no account on account of my black skin. They have no idea. They talk among themselves as if I were deaf. They leave their papers lying on their desks, the which I read while dusting, and remember perfectly, eidetically, from the Greek, eidos, meaning to see. I see and am unseen. Their blindness will be their undoing. As it is for all my knighted children, my lord, my only lord, reminds me, when I pray for my salvation and deliverance from evil, and that he will keep me hidden from their sight.
So, Elizabeth, again, there's the theme of seeing, that the wicked may remain blind.
So here Melinda Miller gives us this woman who manages to use her very invisibility as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I see and am unseen. Their blindness will be their undoing. And of course, in Mary Bowser's case, her invisibility has to do with her being not only a woman, but also a black woman during the Civil War. And I have to say, those words feel incredibly resonant to me right now.
Why do you say that?
You said, Bill, when we first began talking about these poems, about the just relentless news about women being sexually harassed in the workplace. And I can't help but think about how the problem with that is that it refuses to see women's value, their worth. And each of these poems gives us a woman who is finding a way, often with an incredible amount of courage, despite the constraints of her time, to assert her worth. And in these poems, these women are being seen for their worth. That's why it feels relevant to me, that's still a struggle. It's astonishing to me that it's still a struggle.
That's KUOW poetry correspondent Elizabeth Austin. Elizabeth, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
Melinda Miller is going to be reading from Mary's Dust at Elliott Bay Books on Tuesday, December 12th. And you're going to find photographs of these Civil War era Marys, as well as audio of more poems from Melinda Miller's new collection. All of that is at our website, KUOW.org. So you're at a casino, at the blackjack table, and a gambler walks up next to you, asks for some chips, and pays for the chips with bundles of $20 bills he's got stuffed into a hockey equipment bag. Money laundering in casinos has got to stop, says the government of British Columbia. And one reason the Crime Stoppers give is the connection between the roulette wheel and the astronomical price of a Vancouver home. Here to tell you that story, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
So what is this gigantic money laundering scheme that even has its own name? It's the Vancouver model.
Yeah, we've become known around the world as such a mark for money laundering that the way it's done here is considered the Vancouver model. It's so easy to do and so widespread. Essentially, you have drug gangs based in North America and criminal syndicates based in Asia, and they're all flying their money into Vancouver and laundering it through the big casinos in BC. And the extent of this problem is incredible. We had a report to the new Attorney General just a couple of months ago saying that in the single month in 2015, one casino in BC received $14 million in $20 bills.
Wow.
That's a lot of that's 700,000 $20 bills. There is a case of at least one reported case where they were using a hockey equipment bag full of 20s, And they take him into the casino. Yeah, they ask for chips. They cash out the chips in the casino. They get a cashier's check or they get $100 bills or whatever. It's now laundered. And, of course, the other thing the Attorney General is asking, I mean, first of all, he's looking for ways to crack down on this, and he's doing that. Second question he's asking is, where's the money going after it's washed through the casino?
Mm-hmm.
And a sneaking suspicion, he hasn't got a lot of evidence of this yet, but a sneaking suspicion that the money is then going into the most lucrative investment in British Columbia, which is high-end real estate. We've got a lot of homes in BC and property that has been purchased with foreign cash. And the reporting and accounting and paper trail on that money is not as thorough as it should be. So you can conceal the real ownership through trusts and other arrangements. So on the one hand, he's looking to stop the money from coming in. But in the second hand, he's also asking, where's it going when it gets washed through the casino?
Yes. Why does your local government let real estate buyers hide their identity so well?
Well, this is why do we allow people to bring $700,000 $20 bills into a casino without asking questions? What you have here is a market that was unregulated. It was not scrutinized carefully enough. I think we were naive about the extent of the problem. They're starting to crack down on the casinos and make sure that the paper trail is identified, the money trail is identified. They're putting limits on it, putting inspectors in the casinos. And the other thing they're doing is exactly the same thing on real estate. They are starting to open up the reporting and accounting on the real estate, bring in taxes aimed at curbing the practice and curbing speculation. But you know, some of the work has been done. There's been a growing awareness over the last couple of years. But the new Attorney General, David Eby, said when he got his first briefing on this job back in the summer, the public servants who briefed him, the gambling regulators who briefed him said, Minister, we're going to blow your mind. And he said his mind was blown. He had no idea how bad the problem was, how widespread, how long it had gone here. And look, previous government, you have to think they were turning a blind eye because casino gambling was bringing in more than $1 billion in government revenue, and the government was making $2 billion a year off property sales. That was a pretty big contributor to the government's ability to fund public programs, and you wonder how serious they were about the alarm bells that were going off in the regulators about this problem was getting out of hand.
Have any of these Crime Stoppers given you a sense of how realistic it is to prevent gamblers from buying chips with ill-gotten money? I mean, okay, maybe I'll be a little less obvious about my hockey equipment bag stuffed with 20s. I'll hire some assistants and we'll spread out a little bit. And do you any sense as to whether this crackdown is going to work?
Well, the government's brought in one of the leading experts in Canada on money laundering, a guy named Peter German, who's spoken internationally, he's recognized internationally, and he thinks, yes, you can crack down on a lot of this. You can require that significant amounts of cash that are coming into casinos, that the paper trail, the trail of the cash be reported. You can put limits on how much can be gambled in a day. It's $10,000. You can require that bearer bonds or cashier's checks or money orders and all this is scrutinized as well. So he thinks you can. In fact, he's warned the government that these methods, this crackdown, can be sufficiently effective that it will affect the government's revenues coming from the casinos, that they won't be making as much money off of it because the action will be reduced. So, yeah, he actually thinks this is effective. He thinks it was so slack here. That's why we were known, as I said, as easy marks all over the world. The money will perhaps go somewhere else.
Vaughn, we just talk over and over about different ways Vancouver and British Columbia try to make it possible for somebody to afford a place to live in your hometown. Are there any signs that any of these things are working? How's the real estate market in Vancouver?
It's still climbing. You know, I think everything they've done so far has not been enough. They've made, obviously, some progress in a few areas, but the new government promised to deal with this crisis of housing affordability. They've only been in office for 4 months. They haven't done much yet. They're saying wait for their next budget in February and you'll see some real action. They've also acknowledged that you can't just affect the demand side. You're going to have to put a lot of pressure on local government to allow more housing to be built, particularly around transit lines, so you get those big clusters of real estate, of townhouses and so forth around transit lines. So I would say the government has the best of intentions on it, but Bill, we haven't seen a lot of action yet. We're looking to the new year. They're going to have to do something because they promised. This is in part how they won the election, so they're going to have to start acting.
Vaughn Palmer, Vancouver Sun columnist, joining us regularly. Vaughn, thanks a lot for this.
Bye-bye, Bill.
In expensive Vancouver, British Columbia, more expensive than it is here, if you can believe that. And that's all for today on The Record on KUOW Seattle. The program's put together by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel, and I'm Bill Radke. Let's do it again tomorrow. Thanks for listening.